Please do sit down, and I'd like to turn back to Hebrews 4 and 5, page 205 in the Pew Bibles. Why did God wait so long before he sent Jesus into the world? I don't know if you've ever asked yourself, maybe as you've sat in Lent course lectures, why was it that God planned such a long history of Israel before the coming of Jesus? I think it's true to say that some people imagine that the Old Testament is a little bit like God's plan A. God tried it, he tried it for a good few centuries, but it wasn't working too well, and so he decided in a rash moment that he was going to put plan B into operation and send his son. He'd given Israel nearly 2,000 years from the call of Abraham to the birth of Jesus, but then he just had to do something different. Well, I want to say that that kind of thinking is wrong for at least two reasons. The first is that God is consistently presented in the Old Testament as the God who controls history. God is not frustrated or held hostage by historical events. On the contrary, Daniel, writing from exile in Babylon, says, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings." God is governing the whole of human history, says Daniel. God is not a spectator, waiting to see what's going to happen in world events. He is the sovereign king who sets up rulers and removes them. That's the first reason why it would be a mistake to imagine that God was not in control and that he had to wait for an opportune time to send Jesus. And secondly, it would be a mistake because God had planned for Jesus to come and die even before he created the world. 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 9. God saved us and called us, says Paul, with a holy calling, not in virtue of our works, but in virtue of his own purpose and the grace which he gave us in Christ ages ago from all eternity. God planned our salvation before the foundation of the world. So why did he wait so long before he sent Jesus? Well, one reason, and it is a partial reason, is that when the Son of God eventually comes into the world, there need to be some categories by which we human beings can understand him. In other words, there needs to be a context that will interpret Jesus, who he is, why he's come. And that's one of the reasons for the history of Israel, as recorded for us in the Old Testament. They are there to give us categories by which we can understand Jesus and who he is. We saw one example of that in the Lent course on Thursday in the idea of rest, which is a key idea if you look back at chapter 4 of Hebrews. The idea of rest is central to understanding that chapter. But really, you can't understand Hebrews 4 unless you go back to Genesis chapter 2, working your way through the Old Testament to the promise of Jesus in Matthew 11:28, "Come to me, all who labor, and I will give you rest." And then Hebrews 4 is pointing us forward to our ultimate rest in heaven, the place where we will ultimately enjoy God's earth in God's presence. But I hope you see that the Old Testament category of rest, which was the term applied to the promised land, you need that in order to make sense of Hebrews 4. And similarly, in our passage tonight, we're looking at another Old Testament category, the high priest. Now, high priests are a foreign language to people in late 20th century Crowborough. We don't talk about high priests. We don't meet high priests. But God has given us this category in order that we can better understand who Jesus is and why he's come. And chapter 5 and verse 1, for the sake of those of us who are not Jewish and have never encountered a high priest, he gives an important glimpse of what high priests were and what they did in religious life in the Old Testament. So he says, "For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins." So high priests had a particular role in dealing with the sin barrier that exists between God and his people. And God appointed these men, high priests, as go-betweens who would offer sacrifices for sin, so that when God looked on the sacrifice, so he would turn his anger away from his people. But although it was a system that was appointed by God, it was also, for all that, an inadequate system, according to verse 3, because the high priest was himself a sinner. And so verse 3 says, "Because of this, he is bound to offer sacrifice for his own sins, as well as for those of the people." So the high priest, even in the Old Testament, even though he had been chosen by God, given his role by God, he was far from ideal. His presence in the holy place with God was limited. He could never guarantee an ongoing presence with God to intervene on people's behalf. But then that's the whole point of the Old Testament and the history of Israel. They're inadequate and they're incomplete. And they're constantly pointing us forward to something better, to someone who is perfect and complete. And so a far better model for understanding the Old Testament than Plan A and Plan B is to see the relationship as one of promise and fulfillment. Jesus is the one in whom the Old Testament is fulfilled. He is the ultimate and the perfect high priest. And in fact, even the sacrifices that the high priest offers point to Jesus, because Jesus is not only the high priest, but he's the perfect sacrifice offered by the high priest. So Hebrews 9:26, let me just read it to you. "As it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the age to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself." So Jesus is the high priest, and he is also the sacrifice par excellence. So let's look at what this passage has to tell us about Jesus as a high priest. And first, says the writer, Jesus is alive and with God, verse 14. "Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession." Jesus is alive and he is with God. Unlike all the other priests who have lived and died, Jesus lived and died and rose again, never to face death again. "We have a high priest," says the writer, "who has gone through the heavens to be seated at the right hand of God." Because of his obedience to death, God the Father has not only raised Jesus to life, but he has glorified him. He is seated at the right hand of God. Before Christ, the holiest place in the temple was entered only once a year by the high priest. But that was a shadow of the true holy place in heaven, where God lives. That is where our high priest lives today. He has immediate access to God day and night, And Hebrews 7:25 says that he always lives to make intercession for us. Here is our high priest. He's alive and he's with God constantly. And since we have such a great high priest, the application is the first half of the verse. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. Where you're wobbling spiritually, where you're struggling to keep going as a Christian, the writer says, hold on. If you've got a high priest like this, don't imagine that you're on your own in the Christian life. We have a great high priest seated today in the very presence of God the Father, interceding for us day and night. Therefore, don't give in. Keep going. But the temptation maybe for some of us would be to say, well, why should such a great high priest bother with someone like me when I've messed up again and I consistently fail? And that is why we need to see, secondly, that Jesus is perfectly qualified to sympathize with our weakness. Verse 15, for we have not a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. 50 years ago, C.S. Lewis imagined someone objecting in this way. If Jesus never sinned, then he doesn't really know what temptation is like. He lived a sheltered life and is out of touch with how strong temptation can be. Well, this is how C.S. Lewis replied. He says, a silly idea is current that good people do not know what temptation means. This is an obvious lie. Only those who try to resist temptation know how strong it is. A man who gives in to temptation after 5 minutes simply does not know what it would have been like an hour later. That is why bad people, in one sense, know very little about badness. They have lived a sheltered life by always giving in. Christ, because he was the only man who never yielded to temptation, is also the only man who knows to the full what temptation means. He is the only complete realist. In terms of verse 15, we have a high priest who is a complete realist. The fact that he's exalted at the right hand of the Father doesn't mean that he's aloof or out of touch with the struggles and the weaknesses that we face. He's not unsympathetic to the battles that we go through day by day. On the contrary, says the writer, he knows better than any of us what temptation is all about. He knows what it's like to be tempted to lie to save his life, to take revenge when he was wrongly accused, the temptation to self-pity when his disciples rejected him and abandoned him, the temptation to sexual impropriety. The writer says he is able because in every respect he has been tempted as we are, and yet without sin. And therefore the application, verse 16, draw near. Let us then with confidence, he says, draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. All of us here, however long we've been Christians, have needs. All of us have weaknesses And all of us are particularly prone to certain temptations. Whether it's the pornographic web pages on the internet, whether it's gossiping at the school gate, whether it's losing our temper with the children or with our spouse, all of us have particular weaknesses. And we've all failed in those areas. We've sinned. And therefore we know that we don't deserve God's help. And that's why we need to hear from verse 16 that the throne of God is a throne of grace. God doesn't promise to help us because we deserve it. On the contrary, he promises to help us because he is gracious. And therefore, he invites us to draw near with confidence. And that word translated confidence means a bold frankness. Come to him with boldness and frankness. We can come to him with a kind of struggles that nobody else knows that we're going through. Whether it's our financial dishonesty or our sexual fantasy, we can come to this high priest. And the promise is that as we come to him with that bold frankness, so we will receive mercy and find grace. We'll find that as we cry to this high priest, so we will receive his help at exactly the right time. Grace to help at time of need. And then the third aspect of Jesus as high priest that the writer throws up for us here is that Jesus is unique in his dignity. Chapter 5, verses 1 to 6. Having explained, as we've seen, something of the purpose of the high priest in the Old Testament religious system, the writer goes on to say in verse 4, "One does not take this honor upon himself, but he is called by God, just as Aaron was." The role of high priest is a position of great dignity, and you can't just decide to be a high priest. God has to call you to it, just as he called Aaron in the Old Testament. And so, verse 5, "So also Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed by him who said to him, 'Thou art my son, today I have begotten thee.'" Christ didn't take the position of high priest on his own authority. He was appointed by God. And that is what gives Jesus his unique qualification to be our high priest. No priest in the line of Aaron could do it. Only Jesus is qualified to be such a great high priest. And fourthly, he is unique in his eternity, verse 6. As he says also in another place, "Thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." Now Melchizedek is quite an enigmatic character. He's mentioned twice in the Old Testament, in Genesis 14 and then Psalm 110. In Genesis, he meets Abraham coming back from a military campaign, and he blesses Abraham. And the text simply says, he was a priest of God Most High. And that's all Genesis says about him. It doesn't say who his parents were. It doesn't say where he came from. That's it. And then silence for 1,000 years thereabouts until David in Psalm 110 quotes God as saying the Messiah is a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. And even David's contemporaries must have been saying, who? And then that's it again. There's nothing more about Melchizedek until you come to Hebrews 5. So another gap of around 1,000 years. But clearly for the writer, he is an important figure. And the point is, as he will go on to elaborate in chapter 7 particular of Hebrews, that Melchizedek symbolizes a priesthood that is different from the priesthood of Aaron and the tribe of Levi. Melchizedek points to a priesthood that has no beginning and no end. And what Melchizedek pointed to is fulfilled in Jesus Christ. In the words of chapter 7 and verse 3, he has neither beginning of days nor end of life. He is the eternal high priest. He will never die. There will never come a point in all eternity when he will cease to be your high priest. And then finally, Jesus is unique in his obedience, verses 7 to 10. Verse 8 says that although he was a son, he learnt obedience through what he suffered. Now, as we've seen already, that doesn't mean that Jesus moved from disobedience to obedience, but that in his incarnation, in coming to earth, Jesus moved from an untested obedience to an obedience that was tested in the crucible of suffering. And that tested obedience went through real testing. The incarnation was not just pretend. His life was a life of real battle. And so verse 7 talks about him crying out to God with loud cries and tears, offering up prayers and supplication. What verse 7 is talking about is not, I think, that he was praying for deliverance from death, because verse 7 says that he was heard. But he was heard in the sense that verse 8 speaks of. He learnt obedience. Jesus, as we saw in Gethsemane, was praying for obedience to the will of God, even in the face of suffering and death. So that, as verse 9 puts it, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. Through his perfect obedience, tested through unspeakable suffering, he has become the perfect high priest, so guaranteeing eternal salvation for those who obey him. And the application for us? Well, it's that this high priest who has learned obedience, he recognizes that same kind of obedience in his followers. In fact, the sure mark of someone who has experienced his eternal salvation is that they're living now in obedience to him, especially when it hurts to do so. So for the person who breaks off a relationship, when they know it's not one that God can bless, despite the cost involved in the emotional pain, the loneliness and the fear of being left on the shelf, Jesus recognizes that kind of obedience, and as our great high priest, he intercedes. Well, in conclusion, we've seen in previous weeks that this book of Hebrews is written to a group of Christians who are in danger of drifting away from God, of losing their ultimate rest with him. And therefore, Hebrews is a book that is addressed to us, because all of us are in exactly that same position. And as we saw last week, we need to guard our hearts. We need to look out for each other, encourage one another daily, as long as it's called today, so that we don't develop hardened hearts, so that we hear God speak and we respond with faith and obedience rather than disbelief. But this passage tonight has taken us further. You are not alone, says the writer. Not only do we have each other as church to encourage one another to keep going, you also, he says, have a great high priest. A priest who is committed to seeing you brought home to glory. That is the whole mission of Jesus, to bring many sons to glory. And where we struggle, as inevitably we will, the invitation is to draw near to him, to draw near in prayer, and to ask him for the help that we need right now, and to come to him with bold frankness to the throne of grace. Let's pray together.